Well, as we're starting a new series looking at the world wars, looking at propaganda, history is absolutely vital. History tells us what's worked and it tells us what has not worked. We need to develop the ability to recognize these lessons in every area of life. Revelation 11:15 says, "The kingdoms of the world have become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever. All nations will come and worship before you." This is the goal. History is heading towards that. The longer you look back, the further you can look forward. If we don't know our own history, we will simply have to endure all the same mistakes, sacrifices, and absurdities all over again. Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. To be ignorant of what has happened before you were born is to remain a child forever. These are some quotes that just remind us of why we look at history. It is not the remembered past, but the forgotten past that enslaves us. People often say that people are slaves of history. Not if you know your history, but you can be slaves of it if you don't know it. History is and must ever continue to be, next to God's word, the richest foundation of wisdom and the surest guide to all successful practical activity. John Calvin said, "Histories are a true school for learning how to order our lives." Well, history teaches us what's worked and what has not worked. And 1 Corinthians 10 verse 6 says, "Now these things occurred as examples to keep us from setting our hearts on evil things." And as we begin to look at aspects of the world wars, which has so affected our lives and history and our present day, and next time we meet will be in 2 weeks' time on the 8th to look at propaganda. And that's an incredible thing to see how history has been twisted by propaganda and our perceptions of reality. But just to start us off on all this, the bombing of cities in World War II. Most of the pictures that we will show tonight, most people have never seen. And many of the facts that will be presented, if not most of the facts, are not known by the vast majority of people. Even though many may think, oh, I know what happened in World War II. I mean, I've seen how many films of Hollywood. But that's often disinformation, not actually information. Eminent British war historian Captain Sir Basil Littlehart described the strategic bombing campaign by the RAF Bomber Command during the Second World War as the most uncivilized means of warfare that the world had known since the Mongol invasions. And in case you didn't know, the Mongols managed to kill something in the region of 12% of the total world population in the lifetime of Genghis Khan himself. British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain declared that England's policy of bombing cities in Germany was absolutely contrary to international law. Just before being ousted by Winston Churchill's coup, Prime Minister Chamberlain announced, "Her Majesty's government will never resort to the deliberate attack on women and children and other civilians for the purpose of mere terrorism." That was his policy, and he didn't last in office very long. But shortly after replacing Chamberlain as Prime Minister, Winston Churchill declared, "Our supreme effort must be to gain overwhelming mastery in the air. The bombers alone can provide the means to victory." Marshal of the Royal Air Force, Lord Trenchard, as early as 1921, declared that the next war will be won by bombing alone, by destroying the enemy's will to resist. This seems extraordinary considering that flying had only been invented a very short time before. From this perspective, an entire strategic philosophy developed, which was to dominate British and later American military strategy. It was the Italian general Galileo Dohet who predicted that in the next war, bombers would inflict millions of civilian casualties in a matter of days. And this is in fact his textbook, which was studied with great interest in Britain in particular and America as well, and many believed his basic thesis that the bombers could win the wars on their own. You don't need to commit vast amounts of infantry anymore, the bomber will win the war. Stanley Baldwin described this new military philosophy in the House of Commons. "The only defense is offense, which means that you have to kill more women and children more quickly than the enemy if you want to save yourselves." So this is already in the 1920s and 30s, a mindset is developing. Although aircraft were only invented in 1903, and aircraft were first used militarily in the First World War, starting with shooting revolvers at one another, and then throwing darts at one another, and then getting grappling hooks on ropes to try and grip the other ones until they moved to machine guns, and then got even more fancy with double machine guns. And in the First World War, air warfare developed fast. Books and films developed a public dread of aerial bombing out of all proportion to the actual threat. And inspired more by science fiction novels of H.G. Wells and Alexander Korda's film Things to Come, the Royal Air Force experts declared as an article of faith that the bomber will always get through. In fact, Lord Trenchard said, an aircraft can never be a defense against another aircraft. Strangely, these men failed to anticipate that technical developments in one area of warfare are soon matched by countermeasures in other areas. For example, while aircraft had developed rapidly in World War I, and gas warfare had developed rapidly, but so too it was countered by gas masks. And anti-aircraft technology soon caught up with the development of aircraft. And night bombers soon were able to be countered by night fighters. Yet many British politicians and military leaders leapt upon his philosophy of faint hearts. After the disastrous battles of World War I, and the battles were disastrous, I've been to the battle sites in Ypres, and there are 158 British and Commonwealth war cemeteries in and around a 10-kilometre radius around Ypres. It's one of the bloodiest battlefields in the world. And it's not just the places where Belgium isn't just where the French Napoleonic Wars were fought in Waterloo, but the First World War, millions of people died. Incredible. The farmers are still digging up bones and bombs almost anywhere. In fact, in the Battle of Passchendaele, the British managed to put 5 tons of high explosive on every square metre of territory in Passchendaele. 5 tons of high explosive on every square metre. And then they marched their soldiers in, and many of them just disappeared. Whole divisions disappeared into the mud. They'd completely demolished it. And when one general ordered a brigadier to consolidate, he said, you cannot consolidate porridge. And artillery pieces, tanks, everything just disappeared. Finished. They're still digging them up now. Just vanished into the mud. Ypres was hideous. The Somme was hideous. In these battles, such as the Battle of the Somme, more British soldiers were killed in 4 months in the Battle of the Somme, fighting to gain 4 miles of territory, then died on all fronts in 6 years of the Second World War. I mean, that's how bad it was. They lost 60,000 men in one day in the Battle of the Somme. The First World War was the first war fought with 20th century weapons, but with 19th century tactics. They had trenches, they had barbed wire, they had machine guns, they had gas warfare, they had submarines, they had aircraft, they had flamethrowers. But they still had old Napoleonic era type tactics of stand up and swarm forward in mass, and all it did was get the men massacred by the tens of thousands. So the British feared to face the German soldier on the battlefield, and they sought for an indirect way of winning the war. Instead of losing hundreds of thousands of soldiers by facing the German army on the ground, they would drop millions of tons of bombs in German cities from a safe height of 10,000 feet or more. Now, the British military strategists concluded that what had actually won the First World War was the British naval blockade, which had led to starvation conditions in Germany. And many military historians have concluded that it's true. Despite the heroism and technological developments and the sacrifices made by the ground soldiers and the dash and daring of the air war, it was actually the naval war that won the war, because it was all a matter of logistics. In the first few months of the war, Germany won the war, no problem. But the trouble is, France and Britain didn't accept it. They just kept bringing millions more men and millions more bombs and weapons into the war, and the war carried on until Germany ran out of everything, because not having access to the colonies, being tucked away in the centre of the continent, war on two fronts, their navy bottled up effectively, the Royal Navy was just too big and huge, no one could compete. Germany didn't have the raw materials, and they ran out of raw materials, including food. And people were starving by the millions. So the British concluded, forget what happened on the ground. It's the naval war that won it. But now, the starvation blockades of World War I are going to be beaten, and it'll be more effective. We won't have to wait 4 years. to starve a nation into the ground. We can do it now by aerial bombardment alone. So it became an article of faith amongst the chiefs of staff long before the Second World War, decades and a half before the Second World War, that the bombing of German cities would achieve victory in the war without the need to commit the armies to a kind of ground war that had caused so many casualties in the Western Front in 1914 to 1918. Remember, you cannot go anywhere in the English-speaking world without finding a monument to soldiers who died in the First World War. Every little village, every church you go to, they died by the hundreds of thousands. Whole villages were turned into villages of widows wearing black. It was a hideous thing. And remember, in the First World War, units fought in their with their peers from their village. So that's why it was so tragic for any particular unit. You send a whole unit in, you could wipe out all the men of a certain village or district. It was absolutely treacherous. That's why in the Second World War, all armies moved their men around. And the reason was primarily so that no one area felt a loss too heavily. Now, underlying this British philosophy of air war was the assumption that the German civilians would crack under the pressure of sustained bombing. Actually, despite enduring the most sustained aerial bombardment for over 5 years, they never did crack. In fact, war production steadily increased in Germany. Every year, despite increased bombing, war production increased more and more, which is counterintuitive. It goes against all what one would have predicted. Now, the first time that air war was really able to be tested was in the Spanish Civil War. 1936 to 1939, you had the Republicans, who were also allied to the Communists, and you had the Nationalists under General Franco. And in this war, you can see how Barcelona was cut off in this enclave of Communist and Republican sentiment, and of course for Madrid. Now, these are some of the communists. You can see some of the stars on their caps and the clenched fist. There was a very strong communist contingent. And, of course, a lot of people went from all sides. There were volunteers from all over the world fighting in Spain. Well, when during the Spanish Civil War, the Nationalists bombed Barcelona in 1938, reportedly 1,300 inhabitants were killed in this bombing. And this beautiful town of Barcelona being the target of this bombing, the British aerial experts concluded that every ton of bombs dropped would inflict 72 casualties. And this became a mathematically accepted fact. Every ton of bombs equals 72 casualties. In fact, the casualty rates at Barcelona were barely 3 casualties to every ton of bombs dropped. This is part of the problem. Is these people advocating strategic bombing continually misread the facts or deliberately extrapolated and added and put an extra zero there. But this figure was accepted as definitive. And on this basis, the British Home Office predicted 1 million casualties in London in the first few days of the next war. Now, this alarmist nonsense had no basis in fact. In fact, total British death toll from the entire Blitz throughout the entire 5.5 years of the war would be under 30,000. But they were predicting 1 million death toll in London alone in the first few days. It just shows you how alarmist it was. Here's the facts. Of the 500,000 people killed in the entire vicious 3 years Spanish Civil War, less than 3% were killed by air raids. However, as those facts didn't support Bomber Command's philosophy, they were suppressed at the time. So the facts were suppressed because it conflicted with the theory. And here you can see civilians in Barcelona in underground shelters where the trains would have run. People lost their homes. Spanish Civil War was a terrible event. But the fact that the German Luftwaffe had no four-engine bombers, nor any plans to produce any four-engine bombers in the future, was also suppressed. The entire German Luftwaffe was plainly geared to ground support of the Wehrmacht, the Stuka being the classic. The Stuka was a very light plane with a very light bomb load, and they were designed for ground support of Panzer units. The Heinkel 111, which is the primary bomber, and the Stuka were primarily to bomb just in front of the panzers as they advanced in order to crack the defenses of the opposing armies first seen in Poland. Now, plainly, Germany had no intention of strategic bombing of cities because the Heinkel 111 had a miserably small bomb load. Germany's heaviest bomber didn't even have the capacity to carry 10% the payload of bombs that a British Lancaster was designed for. Not even 10%, more like 8%. The British Lancaster, the four-engine bomber, was colossal. This is a Heinkel up close. Notice the size of the people relevant to the aircraft. This is a Lancaster bomber. Notice the difference. A Lancaster is a three-story plane. You've got the bomber observation, you've got the machine gunner, you've got the pilot. Three actual storied plane. It's a colossal plane. If you can try and compare it here, even though the proportions are a bit different because the Heinkel's closer, but the Heinkel has dwarfed it. You could stick many, many Heinkels in a Lancaster. You could put 12 times the Heinkel's bomb load into a Lancaster. Now, the earliest British air raids in Germany were quite disappointing for Bomber Command. They had expected so much. The war's going to be won by the bomber alone in a matter of days. Well, on the 4th of September 1939, the day after Britain declared war on Germany, so they out the gate, the first day of the war, effectively, they're bombing. An RAF bomber attack on a German seaplane base resulted in 24 out of the 28 British bombers being shot down. And the survivors managed to drop a few bombs by mistake on the Danish town of Eisberg, which was 190 kilometers from the target. A very poor first show. Then air raids on the German warships in Wilhelmshaven were also ineffective. The few bombs that hit their targets either didn't explode or bounced off the German armor, causing no damage at all. I don't know if you read the reports in the First World War. In the first year of the First World War, 40% of British artillery shells failed to explode. They're still digging them up in Belgium today. 40% of duds. I mean, that's just incredible. The early casualties suffered by the British bombers were extreme. Two air raids on oil installations in the Ruhr, the industrial Ruhr of Germany, by over 300 British bombers achieved no hits and no damage to any of the plants. Photographic evidence on the RAF bombing raids in the industrial Ruhr in Germany revealed that less than 10% of the British bombers got within 5 miles of their target, and the bombs dropped by these aircraft were dispersed in areas 75 square miles around the intended target. And these bombs dropped by these aircraft were dispersed in such a large area that, as you can see, they're just all over the fields. So they're not hitting their targets. During the air raids of 1940 and 1941, more British aircrew died than German victims of the bombings. This is an extremely poor show. This is meant to be the weapon that wins all wars. And they were spreading the aircraft all over the landscape. The German battlecruiser Scharnhorst and Gneisenau at Brest were attacked by 1,723 bombing sorties by the RAF. Almost 2,000 tons of bombs were dropped on these ships. Yet the Scharnhorst and the Gneisenau survived these air raids mostly unscathed and were fully operational. Just showing air power's not all it's cracked up to be. Not yet. RAF Bomber Command received more funding, more labour, more strategic materials, more equipment than all other branches of the British military combined. They were building bombers by the thousands. And the labour of thousands of workers in factories all over Britain was being scattered across Germany to no good purpose. They were convinced this is where we need to put all of our energy. And you wonder why Britain didn't have enough Spitfires? Because they didn't see the need for fighters. The bomber's going to win the war. Lord Trenchard saw, and he is head of the Air Ministry, he saw no need for fighters. This is why they had so few fighters, because they were putting all their money into bombers. The raw materials that could have been better used to build tanks, ground support aircraft, fighters, dive bombers, machine guns, rifles, medical supplies, these were being squandered to fulfill an obsession with the bomber as the war-winning weapon to beat all weapons. Yet far from winning the war, the bomber almost lost the war for Britain by absorbing the resources that could have been used to equip Britain with genuine weapons of war. Instead of recognizing that the strategic bombing campaign was a failure, the chiefs of staff determined to concentrate their bombing on cities. A policy of terrorizing the German population became a fundamental component of strategic bombing campaign of the RAF. They recognized that the navigational aids were deficient, that the bomb sites used were highly inaccurate. So Bomber Command determined to concentrate entire air wings into 1,000 bomber raids on German cities. This was the magic number, 1,000 bombers at a time. These nighttime saturation bombings wouldn't be able to miss their targets because they'd concentrate in the center of large cities. They would have the Pathfinder bombers that go go over and they would drop parachute flares. My mother mentions standing and seeing the green Christmas trees coming over and seeing them coming down by parachute. And they looked so beautiful. She called them the Christmas trees. And of course, you've got to be getting in the bomb shelter, because that means all the other bombers coming behind, 1,000 bombers, are going to drop their bombs on top of those parachute flares. That's to guide them as to dropping the bombs. If you've seen the film Dresden, you'll appreciate the significance. So killing Germans, any Germans, became the policy of Bomber Command. Okay, we can't hit their factories, we can't hit their bomb, their ships. We can at least hit their cities. They're too big to miss. So we're going to bomb the cities. Between 1940 and 1945, 61 German cities were destroyed in bombing campaigns by RAF Bomber Command. At least 2 million German civilians were killed by the air raids of the RAF and the US Army Air Force at that time. Indiscriminate bombing by international law was forbidden. The Washington Treaty of 1920 expressly forbade the use of bombing against civilian populations. United States government propaganda films, if you've seen the film like Capra's Why We Fight, it is absolutely outraged that the Japanese Empire could bomb cities like Shanghai, and they use it as exhibit A of how, why the Japanese are the most evil people imaginable and worthy of being snuffed out and annihilated and all the rest. And unfortunately, people making the films didn't seem to realize it was their own government's policy to do just the same themselves just now when they got into the war. So a bit of an embarrassment that their own propaganda films didn't seem to coordinate with their own strategy. Upon America's entry into the war, U.S. General H.H. Arnold advocated the policy of strategic bombing of cities as the only way that Germany could be beaten. In fact, the comment made by Churchill was, Germany is a fortress, but it's a fortress without a roof. In other words, we can't get on the ground, but we can sure get in on the top. Small bullet, big sky. Our bombers will always get through. Winston Churchill commented, the air opened paths along which death and terror could be carried far beyond the lines of the actual enemy, to women, children, and the aged, the sick, who in earlier struggles would perforce have been left untouched. It's in Churchill's own memoirs on the Second World War. The Air Ministry historian Dennis Richards, in his official history of the Royal Air Force, wrote, if the Royal Air Force raided the Ruhr, destroying all plants with its most accurately placed bombs and urban property for those who went astray, the outcry for retaliation against Britain might prove too strong for the German generals to resist. Indeed, Hitler himself would probably lead the clamour. The attack on the Ruhr was therefore an informal invitation to the Luftwaffe to bomb London. The principal secretary to the Air Ministry in Britain reported, we began to bomb objectives on German mainland before the Germans began to bomb objectives on the British mainland. Because we were doubtful about the psychological effect of the truth, that it was we who started the strategic bombing offensive, we have shrunk from giving our great decision of May 11th, 1940, the publicity it deserves. This is written by the principal secretary of the Air Ministry, J.M. Spratt, in a book that's got the pathetic title of Bombing Vindicated. And this was the plan. Going out from Britain in waves, the air war would ultimately get all these cities all the way over to, ultimately, Berlin. And you can see how just about all of Europe was within the range of these Lancaster bombers. In an interview with the New York Times, barely a year after the Second World War was over, Air Marshal Tedder declared that Germany lost the war because she had not followed the principle of total warfare. And there's many areas in which Germany did not follow the principle of total warfare. Germany was the only country in the Second World War not to conscript women and put them into factories. In fact, Albert Scheer pleaded with Hitler regularly. He said, if we could conscript women into the factories, we could release 7 million more men into uniform in the army. Our army needs more men. And the Chancellor refused to consider women going to factories. He says, that's what we're fighting to avoid. We want to protect our families. We don't want to put them into the factories. And if you put them in the factories, who's raising the children? So while all other sides conscripted women and put them in factories, Russians, Americans, British, they all put their women to factories, the Germans would not. And they never went to four-engine bombers, and they never went to strategic bombing, and never went to the total war which was being waged against them. Dennis Richards in the Royal Air Force, The Fight at Odds, observed, "Retaliation was certain if we carried the war into Germany. There was a reasonable possibility that our capital and industrial centers would not have been attacked if we had continued to refrain from attacking those of Germany. The primary purpose of these raids was to goad the Germans into undertaking reprisal raids of a similar character on Britain. Such raids would arouse intense indignation in Britain against Germany and so create a war psychosis without which it would be impossible to carry on a modern war." Now, I don't know if you fully grasped this. How many of you have seen the film The Battle of Britain?
Basically, you're saying the Battle of Britain would never have happened.
Indeed. In fact, if you look at the Battle of Britain, it's a brilliant, well-made piece of propaganda. Very, very cleverly done. You get the impression you're getting both sides. Because, you know, it's partly in German, partly in English, with subtitles and all this. But it starts off with the British Army in retreat, Dunkirk and all of that, and the Luftwaffe coming in and strafing, and then there's this scene of the German ambassador meeting with the British ambassador in Switzerland, saying, "Look, you're defeated, your army's left all its weapons behind in Dunkirk. We want peace. We're the same people. The Chancellor doesn't want war with England. You're not our natural enemy," and so on and so forth. And that's true. That was done in 50 different ways, most spectacularly by Rudolf Hess, the deputy Führer, who actually parachuted into Britain most spectacularly in order to try and negotiate a separate peace with Britain. So we know that. But in the film, while it's quite clear that there was this wait because they wanted peace, but then what they're not mentioning is, what the film does not tell you is that already in May, they're bombing cities in Germany. That's even before Dunkirk is over. That's even before the evacuation of Dunkirk. Cities in Germany being bombed. So that's one thing that the film does not tell. But what the film does show is, very nicely, you know, you don't actually see the bombers and you don't actually see the bombs falling. You don't actually see any casualties. But you hear the air raid in Berlin, the lights go out and the searchlights go there and these Luftwaffe pilots stand and make a joke about the fact that Hermann Göring's, got his followers' words because he said that not one bomb will drop on Berlin. They apparently stand in the middle of Berlin smiling about this, thinking that's funny. I doubt if that was the reaction of the people. They don't show the casualties of the bombing of Berlin. They do show the casualties of bombings in London, which was in retaliation. They also show Air Marshal Dowding saying, as their airfields were getting bombarded to pieces and their air factories were getting demolished, "We need a miracle." Immediately after that, the British bomb Berlin, although, as I said, it's very tastefully done so that you don't actually see casualties, but there were. And then you get the next day, the German Air Force shifts and starts to bomb London. And you get all the different responses from the air marshal saying, "Well, I'm not complaining as long as my airfields are left alone. You know, give us time to rebuild and all of that." And they make a light point of it in the film. They refer to it, but they put most of the concentration on the actual bombing of London, which, of course, was a retaliation, a stupid retaliation. They shouldn't have done it either. I mean, bombing of cities, whoever does it, it's wrong. The British jurist F.J.P. Veal, in Advance to Barbarism, observed, "It is one of the greatest triumphs of modern emotional engineering," notice the term, emotional engineering, "that in spite of the plain facts of the case, which could never be disguised or even materially distorted, the British public throughout the Blitz period of 1940 to 1941 remained convinced that the entire responsibility for the sufferings it was undergoing rested on the German leaders. Too high praise cannot therefore be lavished on the British emotional engineers for the infinite skill with which the public mind was conditioned prior to and during a period of unparalleled strain. The inhabitants of Coventry, for example," we all know Coventry, I mean, they suffered this bombing, and that was a name that just resounded because Coventry was bombed by the Germans in retaliation for the bombing of Germany. "The inhabitants of Coventry, for example, continue to imagine that their sufferings are due to the innate villainy of Adolf Hitler, without a suspicion that a decision, splendid or otherwise, of the British War Cabinet was the decisive factor in this case. This is all a quote from Advance to Barbarism, the Development of Total Warfare. And Sir Archibald Sinclair, Secretary for Air, declared, I'm in full agreement of terror bombing. I'm all for the bombing of working class areas in German cities. Now, why bombing of working class areas? People said, when you bomb the inner cities, you're bombing the working class. The richer people in the suburbs on the outskirts who will be less affected. And said, but there's more people living in the small, in the closer, denser areas in the middle, so you get more death for each ton. Therefore, bombing the working... Anyway, the working class people are the ones in the factories and who are producing everything that's making the country go. So if you can kill the workers, you're undermining the whole country. And that was the kind of attitude. 5th of July 1941, the city of Munster in Germany was bombed by 63 British Wellington bombers just after midnight. See, they first tried daylight bombing and they lost a lot of people. So they went for nighttime bombing because at that stage night fighters hadn't been developed. The city was unprepared and it was without any anti-aircraft protection. And you can see the kind of newspaper reports with excitement over bombing. Notice it doesn't speak about bombing people, but bombing Nazis. Dehumanize enemy, that's also a trick of propaganda. By the end of the war, more than 90% of the historic city of Munster was destroyed. 90%. On the night of 28 March 1942, 234 Wellington bombers and Stirling bombers dropped over 400 tons of bombs on Lübeck, a beautiful historic city.
Yeah, that's where I come from.
Lübeck, that's where the marzipan
comes
from. You would remember this beautiful church spires, which are so symbolic of Lübeck. 1,468 buildings were destroyed, 2,180 were seriously damaged, and 9,000 buildings were lightly damaged. 62% of all buildings in Lübeck were damaged or destroyed. And this is some of what you can see after the cleanup. On the night of the 30th of May 1942, Cologne was destroyed by RAF Bomber Command. Look at the devastation. This is one of the great cities of the Reformation, Cologne, or Cologne. 2,000 tons of high explosives were delivered by 1,046 bombers in 90 minutes. Luftwaffe Commander Hermann Göring refused to believe the reports. It's impossible, he said. That many bombs cannot be dropped in a single night. 2,000 tons of high explosive bombs? There's not enough planes out there to do that. No planes can carry that. It's impossible. And these are the pictures showing how possible it was, taken at the time. This is Cologne after the bombing. The first of the 1,000 bomber raids. And this magnificent cathedral just devastated. On the 25th of June 1942, the British launched 1,067 bombers against the German port city of Bremen, one of the most important of the naval ports. And this air raid succeeded in killing only 85 people, but it destroyed 572 houses for the loss of 53 aircraft. You think how many crew there are on each aircraft. This wasn't exactly a successful raid, Bremen. Yet, the British newspapers triumphed over the fact that Bremen was ablaze in a 1,000 bomber raid, and it even describes them as terror bombing. I mean, we've got the newspapers of the time, English press, speaking about terror bombing of cities, as though that's a good thing. Now, just think for a moment, 10 years ago, what you felt on September the 11th, 2001, when you heard about planes flying into buildings in New York and over 2,000 people being killed in one go. I mean, just think of the shock and the horror. Now, that's terrorism. What do you call 1,000 planes dropping thousands of tons on a city? Now, the British bombed by night, but the Americans bombed by day. And these are the Americans bombing by day over Bremen. That's what the caption says. British bombers over Bremen, the B-17 flying fortresses. And so the Stars and Stripes are trumpeting all the bombing that they're happily doing. Notice the British, the Americans, and the Russians are hitting Nazis by air. And so they're thinking this is all a great thing. They're coming from England, they're coming from North Africa, and they're doing ongoing bombing, and they think that this is something that everyone should be thrilled about. Just to read about the destruction. In fact, it said, the last terror raids were carried out to impress Molotov. Molotov was the Soviet foreign minister. Because the Luftwaffe was not equipped with strategic bombers, the contrast between the casualties caused by the Blitz in England and the saturation bombing of German cities is stark. You know, it's basically like somebody takes this catapult and shoots you, and you pull out your RPG and shoot him. It just, that's not equivalent. Coventry lost 100 acres through bombing. Approximately 300 people lost their lives in Coventry during that horrific air raid by the Luftwaffe. Yet the RAF bombing of Hamburg killed 70,000 civilians in one 24-hour period. This is Hamburg before the raid. You can see a beautiful medieval city. And this is called Operation Gomorrah, the Hamburg firestorm raids. They dropped first bombs that would blow all the roofs off, and then they dropped incendiary devices that would start fires. Between the 24th of July and the 2nd of August, RAF Bomber Command unleashed Operation Gomorrah against the coastal town of Hamburg in Germany. Not a particularly strategic city, but the lead bombers dropped parachute flares to guide the following bombers to where to release their bombs in the dark. 8,000-pound blockbusters and 4,000-pound cookie bombs knocked out the roofs and the windows, and subsequent waves dropped 350,000 incendiary bombs to start fires. Crews of the Halifax bombers reported masses of raging fires in Hamburg rising to 19,000 feet. They had to change their approach because they would go into the fire. They had to go much higher than the normal operating altitude. They were in danger of literally losing consciousness. They had to go so high. And the oxygen was being sucked out of the air, even up to 19,000 feet. This is Hamburg afterwards, after they've cleaned the streets. As you can see, the streets have been swept of the rubble. As the waterworks were destroyed first, there was no running water with which the fire brigade could extinguish a sea of flames, which soon engulfed the entire city. The next day, while the people are no doubt going around days trying to pick up the pieces and deal with survivors, 25th of July, the US Army Air Force B-17 Flying Fortress bombers unleashed further destruction on the stricken city of Hamburg. The British only lost 12 aircraft during the night raid, but the Americans lost 15 aircraft during the day raid. For 10 days and 10 nights, the RAF and the USA Air Force continued a relentless day and night bombardment of the doomed city. 16,000 residential buildings in Hamburg were destroyed. Incredibly, by the end of 1943, the aircraft industry, the chemical industry, the submarine building factories are all back to almost pre-bombing capacity. This is the thing that continually amazes one, is that the bombing of the cities did not seem to stop the war production. Killed a lot of people, caused a lot of suffering, but spectacularly, they continued to repair, to rebuild very fast. 70,000 civilians, though, had died in the 10-day firebombing of Hamburg. And there's very heartrending stories. I mean, you're talking about whole families, all ages. And this is some of the wreckage of Hamburg on the docks. And you can imagine what type of bomb lifts up a locomotive or throws a bus into holes like this. The devastation of the streets. And how many wounded, injured, crippled, and psychologically damaged people as a result. Now, I've seen reports in history book saying Adolf Hitler never visited the site of any bombings. Well, here's a picture showing he did. So I don't know how they can say that, but there's a lot of rubbish in history books, which you just need to remember that history is often written by the victors, and my history teacher in Rhodesia said, beware the victor's version. Propaganda during wartime becomes history in peacetime. He said, you've got to look at everything highly skeptically. This is a propaganda poster used by Germany. The enemy sees your light. Darken. Switch off your lights. The point is blackout at night. And I even remember being brought up like that in Rhodesia. You never switch on the light without first closing the curtain. You never go out the front door without first switching off the light. That's how it was in Rhodesia fighting terrorists. And my mother would remind me, well, we had to do that also when we were growing up in Germany. And my dad said that's what he had to do when he was in England too, because they were also getting some of that as well. These are just some of the artist's impressions of what it would be like bombing a defended city where they had some air defense. Not every city had air defense though. And towns got turned to rubble. And you can just imagine, here it shows what it looked like before, in this case Dusseldorf. How many beautiful churches and buildings and homes, and irreplaceable artifacts and historic items. Destruction of cities beyond comprehension. The German Parliament itself. But the destruction of Dresden was the worst of all. Between the 13th and the 14th of February, which, by the way, falls over Valentine's Day, the city of Dresden was destroyed by over 2,000 bombers of the RAF and the USA Air Force. Dresden had been chosen as a target by the Soviets at Yalta. This is the Zwinger, which is one of the most beautiful Baroque palaces, which got destroyed in the bombing. This is one of the beautiful churches. I think there's the Frauenkirche. Joseph Stalin persuaded Churchill and Roosevelt at Yalta to target Dresden, which was a major receiving area for refugees fleeing the Soviet advance on the Eastern Front. It was also the premier cultural city of Germany. Many called it the Florence of the North. No aerial defense. It was an open city. There was no... Why would anyone bomb Dresden? Dresden is famous for China. The city is swollen with civilians fleeing the Red Army's rapid and destructive advance. On the evening of the 13th of February, 1945, the war's almost over. 796 Lancasters and 9 de Havilland Mosquitoes dropped 1,478 tons of high explosive and 1,182 tons of incendiary bombs between 10 and 11. 3 hours later, while the people were coming out of the bomb shelters and trying to deal with the casualties, another 1,800 tons of bombs were dropped by a second group of Lancasters. So this is a mean tactic to space out your bombings, because they knew the people couldn't stay in those bomb shelters for long. In fact, many of the people asphyxiated because of the firestorm sucked all the air out, and the bomb shelters could no longer sustain life because there was no oxygen in the air. The first official reports on air raids in Dresden described as one of the most successful of the 1,000 bomber raids. Our pilots report that there was little flak, that they were able to make careful and straight runs over the targets without bothering much about their defences. Well, why wasn't there any anti-aircraft flak? A terrific concentration of fires was started in the centre of the city. This is the official report announced in BBC. And this is a picture taken by the second wave of bombers going over Dresden, actually taken at that time. That's Dresden burning from the first bombing, and now several hours later, 3 hours later, the second group of bombers are about to unleash even more. The British described this raid as one of the most powerful blows promised by the Allied leaders to the Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin at Yalta. That's when they betrayed the whole of Eastern Europe into the hands of this communist dictator, the mass murderer of all mass murderers. Now, if you've seen the film Dresden here, you've got a little inkling. But what the film stops with is the British bombing overnight. It doesn't show you the American bombing that came the next day. Allied bombers who were involved in the firebombing of Dresden later recalled the sense of shame they felt when no anti-aircraft fire or night fighters opposed the bombing of the city. They said they felt ashamed. You know, if people were at least shooting back, they'd feel like this is something of a contest. Numerous historians and jurists have described the bombing of the cities of Germany as a war crime and as a Holocaust. This is Dresden. This is Dresden waterfront. This is the buildings afterwards. Never in history has more people been killed in a single place at a single time. This is the worst single act of massacre in the history of the world. The death toll, they started out with 80-something thousand. They went to 130,000. It climbed to 250,000. Today, it's believed it's probably 500,000 that died there because there were so many refugees swelling the normal population that had poured in from the Soviet advance, which was only about, 70 kilometers away? The Soviet army was driving there. People were pouring into Dresden. It was one big hospital city. And they bombed it when it was at its most swollen. Yet, believe it or not, British Air Marshal Bomber Harris, the Bomber Command Chief, directly responsible for saturation bombing of civilian centers, was knighted for his efforts. You normally think of knights being the sort to protect women and children, not those who are doing things that the Saracens and the Muslims would have delighted to do. The news reports from neutral countries like Sweden and Switzerland pointed out that Dresden was one large hospital city swollen with refugees fleeing the advancing Red Army. They also pointed out that the main railway station outskirts of town was unaffected by the bombing. According to the Allied history, they said they targeted Dresden because it was an important rail junction. But the railway junction was not hit. They entirely hit the city, not the main railway station outskirts of town. 22 hospitals had been destroyed in Dresden. One British commentator asked at the time, who the devil is going to get anything out of it? We contribute the bombs and the machines and the crews who don't return from these air raids. The Dresdeners themselves don't get anything out of it, naturally. The only ones who look like they're getting anything out of this are the Russians. They get Dresden at our expense. I don't see any reason why we should go and kill people for the benefits of the Russians alone, do you? Now that's a British commentator at the time. An Associated Press radio dispatch put out from Paris was broadcast throughout the United States describing deliberate terror bombings of German population centers. This is AP. Carried out by heavy bombers of the Allied Air Forces on residential sections of Berlin, Dresden, with an unprecedented day and night assault on the refugee crowd capital with civilians fleeing the red tide in the east. These are the American superfortresses during the day. It looks like confetti falling down from those bombers. The Americans had traditionally viewed with suspicion the RAF Bomber Command's strategy of bombing cities. Now Americans learned from AP that American bombers were involved in the same terror raids on civilians. The report noted that as all available German air forces were concentrated in the Eastern Front to combat the Red Army's offensive, which threatened to destroy Germany and all of Europe, the targeting of civilian centers in Germany at this time seemed exceptional cowardice because the air forces were not available. They were entirely at the Eastern Front. This is Dresden after the bombing. It's almost impossible to imagine. 1 year later, Dresden residents were still digging the corpses out of the ruins. This report calculated at the time about 200,000 persons in Dresden that they had found the corpses for at that time. And today, most scholars would say, you know, it could easily be 500,000, what with all the refugees that were in there. But they found the bodies of about 200,000. Now, what are we to say about the men involved in the bombing command? First thing you need to know is these men were lied to. They were told all sorts of rubbish. And I think the Dresden film gives a good feel of this, where they say, oh, you know, there's Gestapo headquarters downtown, and there's a lot of soldiers there, and they have a poison gas producing factory. You know, they lied to the Bomber Command people. But many of the Bomber Command people said, we knew it was lies. We didn't believe it. This is one of the crews that actually bombed Dresden. I don't know how they feel about it today. But as this AP news report was widely broadcast by radio throughout the United States, General Eisenhower and General H. Arnold cabled General Spatz to clarify that the U.S. Army Air Force was only targeting military objectives and not engaged in area bombing of cities, which is incredibly hypocritical because Eisenhower was party to this. It's not like General Spatz was making this kind of decision on his own. But General Carl Spatz gave an ambiguous and dishonest assurance that the U.S. Army Air Force only attacked military objectives. And that, of course, is just not true. That's a lie. Governments have been lying for a long time. You can always tell when a politician's lying, his lips move. And even when he dies, he lies still. So, these are the kind of bombing pictures that they produced on their own efforts. You know, what do you think that represents down there in the inferno? Even more incredibly, the American bombers were ordered to fire machine guns and strafe the civilians on the ground. And even their Mustangs came down and the machine gun people in the streets, and they were told to create more confusion in the city and to keep the streets clogged and to prevent Dresden from being able to be used as a thoroughfare to the Russian front. So there actually was the machine gunning of civilians, and they didn't just bomb it in February. They bombed it again and again, and the Americans as late as April were bombing Dresden again.
What was I'm just having problems with the Soviets. Why were the Allies making so many concessions to the Soviets?
That's because, a very good question.
Because why would you want you? They must have known Stalin's intentions, that he wanted to actually advance his agenda,
yes,
as well. So why give him any concessions?
Well, this is what we're definitely going to look at in much greater detail. I don't want to suggest that the soldiers on the ground of the different armies didn't, in many cases, really believe they were doing their duty and doing the right thing. But at the top high command, the politicians, there were some evil doings. I don't see any reason whatsoever for America's involvement in the Second World War in Europe. Japan attacked them, of course, that had war in the Pacific, but they only put 10% of effort in the Pacific. They put 90% of men and materials over into Europe. And most of the weaponry coming out of the American factories in 1942, 1943, 1944 went to Russia, not to Americans or the British. The Russians were being armed to the teeth by the Americans. And do you know that Britain had to pay America back for every bomb and bullet it ever got?
Yeah.
And it paid back for decades. Russia didn't have to pay a penny. It was all free to Russia. Stalin got the weapons free. Britain had to pay.
Yeah.
Rhodesia was paying war debt for some tanks and planes and so on we got for our army that we used in the Second World War. Rhodesia was paying for decades afterwards its war debt. South Africa was paying its war debt and settled its debts, by the way, one of the few countries that did. Russia never even was required to pay a cent. They never even got a bill. Why? Now, when America was attacked at Pearl Harbor, which is another story entirely, but you would have thought America's attacked by Japan, therefore America should use all its military forces to deal with Japan. But
the natural enemy as well, it's in the Pacific, it's right there.
And they've been attacked by Japan.
Yeah.
They hadn't been attacked by Germany. Suddenly, 90% of America's manpower and military got rushed to Europe. Why? Because who cares about America's interest? The real serious problem is the Soviet Union is about to collapse. And I can only conclude from my study of the Second World War over most of my life, the main reason for FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, getting America involved in the Second World War was to save Stalin's Soviet Union. There is so much evidence that FDR's wife was a communist, that just about everybody here pointed to everything from the man who started the UN, Olga Hiss, as a KGB agent, through the man who started the International Monetary Fund as communist. There's a lot of evidence on the conspiracies that, in fact, FDR's administration was thoroughly socialist, friends of the communists. The best, the nicest, most charitable thing you can say about FDR is he was a useful idiot. But he might have been worse than that. And the American people were conned into a war that they were totally against getting involved in. I believe not to support American interests, which plainly were in the Pacific, but to save Soviet interests.
Mm.
What did America or Britain get, or South Africa, or any other Western ally, at Canada, New Zealand, Australia, what did we get for our involvement in the Second World War? We lost our empire. And Africa has turned into one big socialist mess and playground, battleground for the Cold War. So I'm convinced that, in fact, the main goal of the Second World War from the Western Allies' perspective was to save the Soviet Union. They say they went to war to save Poland, but Poland was handed over to the communists.
Yeah. Mm.
So obviously Poland didn't help, didn't get any help. And by the way, the Soviet Union invaded Poland at the same time. So how did the Soviets become the Allies' ally to fight to free Poland? Obviously, Poland wasn't the real issue. In fact, there's even a book written about the murder of the head of the Polish army, because he is standing in the way, the Poland who is fighting for the Allies. That's another story. I don't want to get off our main point. But the Soviet Union was in danger of collapsing and being overthrown. There was no doubt. And the only thing that saved them was American arms and supplies, British and American bombing of German cities, and of course the Western Front opening up as well, which diverted more of the forces so that the Soviet Union could survive. Why did Britain and France declare war on Germany on 3rd of September 1939? Because Germany invaded Poland. Okay, Poland wasn't a democracy. Poland was run by a dictator wearing much the same kind of military uniform that Adolf Hitler was wearing too. It was no democracy in Poland. Poland was an aggressor nation that had in fact swiped territory from everyone, including Czechoslovakia and Lithuania and Ukraine and Germany. And they were actually killing German civilians in Poland. So the Polish government was not a democracy any more than Kuwait was a democracy. So the war wasn't to fight to restore democracy to Poland because there wasn't any. So Poland was, since 1923, a dictatorship. So it didn't have very much, it's a very short time of democracy.
There might have been an overreaction... because of the fact that Germany was the enemy in World
I. Could be, but I think that there's a lot more to it than that. The first thing is that if the goal of Britain and France was to save Poland, then why did they not declare war on Russia, who had just taken half of Poland at the same time?
Mm.
and invaded Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, and Finland, mind
they
you.
They actually reacted slowly, but didn't they eventually react?
Not really, because the Second World War ended with Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia in the Soviet hands, yeah, and it, yeah, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, and Romania, Bulgaria, half of Germany.
And then,
it was a pretty bad thing. The point is, if the goal was, okay, you can't say that the Western Allies cared about Eastern Europe because they betrayed the whole of Eastern Europe into the hands of the communists at the end of the war. Mm. Maybe they were fighting for Western Europe, but Western Europe was never endangered until they declared war on Germany. And then Germany, not wanting to fight a two-fronted war, did a counter and then defeated France. I'm sure they didn't mind that because they had scores to settle after the Versailles Treaty. But nevertheless, after that, they were offering peace, withdraw back to Siegfried Line, and hand over the whole of the West. They were offering it right up to the end, even when Hess parachuted in, we'll withdraw from everywhere in the West. So the West could have got, in 1941, everything that they achieved by 1945 without losing a single man. They could have got the liberation of France, Holland, Belgium, everything else they wanted, peace, freedom, Britain keeps its empire. Maybe that's not a good idea, because maybe that was the goal, that Britain lose its empire, that Africa gets rid of all the European colonials who've been civilizing and developing it. But what happens is, after the First and Second World War, Europe's no longer the world's superpower militarily, economically, politically, or spiritually. Europe's no longer the greatest missionary-sending force in the world. Europe's no longer ruling the world. Instead, the backwaters of Russia and America become the two new superpowers at the expense of Europe, and unfortunately at the expense of Africa too, because we become the battleground. So that's my, in a nutshell, perspective on it.
From my memory, this is obviously where I was presented it, as far as I was taught it, the Soviet Union were portrayed, well, as it was portrayed to me, that the Soviet Union took advantage of the West's sort of reaction, mm-hmm, to sort of swindle everybody out of Eastern Europe. So take advantage of their efforts, mm, basically use them to take, yeah, control of Eastern Europe, and then,
yes,
that evolved into the
I think that's a spin which makes the Western leaders look more like they were fooled, but they didn't have intentional treachery. But there's quite a bit of evidence that shows otherwise, because, for example, we had General Patton racing ahead into Czechoslovakia, liberating Czechoslovakia on his way to Prague, and ordered, no, turn around, Czechoslovakia is being handed over to the communists. That's got to be Soviet. He said, I can get to Berlin before Zhukov. No, Zhukov's got to get there first, hold back. Eisenhower turned off the fuel. The Third Army of Patton literally ground to a halt. No more fuel in the tanks, because Patton was advancing too fast. It was messing up the Yalta Agreement, which gave the whole of Eastern Europe to Soviets. And even after the war ended, and the Soviets have taken not Eastern Europe, but actually Central Europe, East Germany and Czechoslovakia, that's Central Europe. That's not Eastern Europe. Russia's Eastern Europe. So really it's Central Europe that's been betrayed. 3 million Russians who were refugees in Europe, like the Cossacks, were forced under Operation Keelhaul, under orders of Eisenhower and others, to be handed over to the Soviets. 3 million.
Probably all to be murdered.
Well either murdered or put in concentration camps as slave labor.
Was it not just the enemy of my enemy is my friend? Was it not a situation?
But
like
within
that,
minutes of the war ending,
no interest in that,
but almost immediately after the war, Russia and America are embroiled in the Cold War, and soon they're fighting one another in places like North Korea. So plainly, anybody with a bit of foresight could see Stalin's a horrible dictator. In fact, in what sense is he a democracy? You know, this fighting for democracy propaganda obviously is not very true when your biggest ally is the worst mass murdering dictatorship in history. So I find a lot of the propaganda about Second World War extremely hard to believe. But we will get there. We want to deal with propaganda in 2 weeks' time, but let me just finish this off. I'm quoting still from American historian Professor Arthur Barnes, who said it was the indiscriminate bombing of civilians by so-called strategic air forces during the Second World War which culminated in the destruction of Dresden, a wholly non-military objective, in February 1945. That completely pulverized the code of civilized warfare and returned the treatment of military opponents and civilians to the level of the primary warfare that had prevailed amongst the savages, the Assyrians, and the medieval Mongols. This, by the way, if you're wondering what you're looking at, is a pile of bodies in Altmark Square, the central square in Dresden. On the basis of the most authoritative British sources, Mr. Veal demonstrates clearly that it was the British, not the Germans, who introduced indiscriminate strategic bombing, despite the efforts of Hitler to avert this reversion to barbaric practices. I don't know if you've ever considered the fact that everyone was carrying gas canisters in the Second World War, all the soldiers. But no side used gas in war. And if the Nazis were as evil as was described, why did they not unleash gas? Everyone had gas. Gas warfare was an option. You could have dropped the gas by planes on population centers, but nobody did that. And it's interesting that these barbaric practices of bombing cities has been so camouflaged. I don't know if you've seen films like Memphis Belle and Hanover Street, which are lovely sort of stories of the bombers, and you're sort of meant to feel for these. Those guys are dropping bombs on civilians, and in Memphis Belle they even have this stupid scene at the beginning where the chap says, now you've got to really be sure about your target because there's a school close to this factory. Oh, come on. They weren't targeting, they were dropping on everything. There was no attempt to avoid bombing schools. They wanted saturation bombing of the entire cities. And so these Hollywood films are plain lying propaganda. And they try to portray these bombers as people are concerned not to bomb a school. Kidding. The German town of Kassel, one of my uncles lived in Kassel, I visited there. The German town of Kassel suffered over 300 air raids, some by 1,000 bomber raids, the British by day, the British by night, the Americans by day. This is Kassel Square after one of those bombings, and you can see the ambulance-type vehicles. On the 4th of April 1945, when the city surrendered, barely 15,000 people remained of the original population of 250,000. Weiner Neustadt in Austria emerged from the air raids with only 18 houses intact, and its population of 45,000 reduced to just 860. This is another town in Germany. As you can see, it doesn't look like there's much left. It looks pretty lunar. But can I point out to you, do you notice in every town there is a church? And this is what people in Europe should have been thinking. On both sides, they're bombing communities with churches in the middle. What does this tell you? Why would you bomb fellow Christians? The London Times review of the British official history of the strategic air offensive commented, one closes these volumes feeling uneasy. I mean, this is incredible. This is a British review on the Royal Air Force's own history of the strategic air offensive. The London Times said, one closes these volumes feeling uneasy, that the true heroes of the story they tell are neither the contending air marshals, nor even the 58,888 officers and men of Bomber Command who were killed in action. The heroes were the inhabitants of the German cities under attack. This is a British London Times review of the Royal Air Force's own history. The men, women and children who stoically endured and worked on amongst the flaming ruins of their homes and factories up until the moment when the Allied armies overran them. How about that? That they could actually say that. Every one of these statistics, the 2 million dead and the millions more scarred and wounded, they were individuals with part of families. In the course of watching a British propaganda film showing the bombing of German cities from the air, British Prime Minister Winston Churchill suddenly sat bolt upright and he asked Lord Casey, are we beasts? Are we taking this too far? Winston Churchill even got to that point. Throughout the world, there were shockwaves of revulsion against the bombing of Dresden. At the time, Sweden, Switzerland, the Red Cross, they were just outraged. There was a lot of complaints. It's amazing how it's been mooted out of our history books now. But this compelled the propaganda ministry to seek to generate as much counter-accusations of atrocities against the enemy to justify the targeting of whole cities for destruction. When people were coming, as the liberating armies are coming and finding, we did this? Why? How could we? We thought we were the good guys. So soon, pictures of starving inmates of labor camps were being published widely. Ah, look at the atrocities that the Germans are guilty of. The fact that the starvation was caused by the naval blockade and the aerial bombardment of Germany was, of course, not pointed out. The first person to draw my attention to this was General Ben Parton of the US Air Force, who's one of our board members and who's the founder of Strategic Bombing using precision-guided weapons. He said he was too young to fight in the Second World War. He fought in the Korean War and the Vietnam War, but he came into the Air Force just after the Second World War, and one of his jobs was to actually analyze the bombings of the Second World War on Germany. And he came to the revulsion of it, thinking, this is so reprehensible, so indefensible. He determined and prayed to God to guide him to find precision-guided weapons. And he's the one who started laser-guided weapons and all the rest, precision-guided weapons, he said, because he wanted to avoid the fact that America would ever gain bomb cities. He said, if you've got to take out a bridge, let's take out the bridge and leave the city around it. And so he prayed for the means, and he started, in fact, most people don't know what laser stands for. Light Amplified Stimulated Emission Radiation. And he chose the name back in 1950s as he started targeting. And he said to me, when he showed me this picture, actually, and General Parton said, what does this tell you? I said, hideous conditions of the concentration camps. He said, really? Why do you think they were starving? Everyone was starving in Germany in 1945. We'd bombed the hell out of the country. Virtually every harbour, railway, junction, bridge in Germany had been bombed. All basic services had broken down. The final months of the war, starvation was widespread. Everyone was starving. This is what the railway lines looked like. This is what the railways looked like in Germany. These are pictures of the bombing of infrastructure in Germany. Bombing of bridges. No wonder people are starving in camps. Because every bridge and every railroad and every road had been bombed. And why were there so many people dead in these camps? Typhus. Here's a British camp, a British soldier at Belsen concentration camp. Dust spreads typhus 5 miles an hour. Drive slowly because the dust will spread the typhus. Even picture of German civilians like this picture. This picture, which was taken in Altmark of Dresden people about to be burned on a funeral pyre, this was published in Life magazine as Jewish victims of German death camps and concentration camps. Yeah. Fact. There's piles of them. Look at these multi-story buildings behind. Concentration camps have high-rise buildings. This was published in Life magazine. Victims of death camps in Germany. And they did this time and again. Now, these are real pictures shown to me by General Parton of, this is now at Dachau. American liberators picturing the starving inmates of this camp. Do you see any of the starving inmates we just saw? Not really. And these people? These are Dachau inhabitants being liberated. American soldiers in Dachau had German civilians drag victims of typhus into the showers, which Americans then claimed had been gas chambers. Documented fact. This here is a gas chamber in the laundromat where they use Zyklon B to get rid of the typhus, the lice. So imagine this, you've got this camp that's meant to kill people. So the first thing you do is you strip them, delouse them, you shower them, you give them haircuts, you give them clothes, only you tattoo them. And the whole purpose of this is so that you can kill them. Why? All parties later agreed that there'd never been a gas chamber at Dachau. The Americans were ordered by the courts to dismantle a structure they'd built after the war to show the tourists. And today it's agreed there never was any gas chambers in Germany. And they had to admit it. But by then, virtually all the prison wardens at Dachau had been massacred by the American forces for the crimes which are now admitted hadn't even taken place there. These are American soldiers shooting all the prison guards in cold blood. And here's the prison guards shot in cold blood outside Dachau. They were shot for a crime which the Americans later admitted hadn't happened. And here again, outside one of the towers. The American judge at the Nuremberg trials, Nicholas Biddle, later acknowledged that Germany had actually waged a much cleaner war than we did, quote unquote. Winston Churchill acknowledged that had Germany won the war, he could have been tried as a war criminal for having authorized the bombing of cities. He even writes that in his own book. By the way, do you know that Winston Churchill, well, this is it, beware the victor's version.
Well, make sure you're on the winning side, you know.
Okay, consider this. I mean, dare I say this with an American present, but if the Confederates had won the war between the states, would Abraham Lincoln have a big statue in America? Would he be considered such a great hero? He would be a war criminal.
Yeah.
He would be cursed. He would be put amongst the worst names in history for having waged this war against the good people of the South when all they wanted to do was have their freedom. But because he won, Abraham Lincoln's lifted up to being a wonderful man who saved America, whereas actually he led America into war that wasn't necessary. 650,000 people died. Why? More Americans died in the American War between the States, the Civil War, than died in all other conflicts America's involved in combined so far. So the fact that Churchill is a hero is because he was on the winning side. The fact that Lincoln's a hero in America today is because he was on the winning side. If they'd lost, their war crimes were, I mean, Lincoln's war crimes were huge. When you think of Sherman's march through Georgia, the destruction of Atlanta and all the rest of it, just hideous. But it's true. If Winston Churchill had been on the losing side, his name and face would be to us like Adolf Hitler's is, the epitome of evil, because his crimes would be splashed all over the history books and there'd be all sorts of films on it, and people would say, how could this man authorize the bombing of cities like Dresden? Marshal of the RAF, now Lord Trenchard, once declared, I can't write what I mean, I can't say what I mean, but I expect you to know what I mean. This is the man who laid the groundwork for the whole Bomber Command philosophy. Lord Trenchard, reviewing RAF, Lord Trenchard's statue. Yeah, you can even build statues to mass murderers of women and children today. The official historian of the strategic air offensive, Sir Charles Webster, noted that half of the bomber sorties made over Germany were a complete waste of time. The weapon with which most British bombers were armed, the general purpose bomb, was so unreliable, so ineffective as to constitute a waste of strategic resources. Between 1939 and 1945, Bomber Command dropped over 500,000 500-pound general purpose bombs and nearly 150,000 250-pound general purpose bombs. Not only were these bombs unsuited to the task for which they were used because of their general characteristics, which consisted of an unhappy compromise between strength of casing and weight of explosive, but they were also relatively inefficient and all too often defective weapons. Many of them didn't even explode. They're still digging them up today. It's estimated that nearly 40% of all the bombs dropped by the British in 1940 failed to detonate, roughly the rates of their First World War artillery barrages. Even the 4,000-pound bombs frequently broke up on impact without even exploding. Okay, here you've got the 40-pound general purpose, then you've got the 500-pound general purpose, here you've got the 1,000-pound general purpose, the 2,000-pound general purpose. I've got a picture of me next to a 2,000-pounder in Sudan that hadn't exploded. 4,000-pound, the 12,000-pound, the 22,000-pound, that's the Grand Slam. There wasn't a plane in the German infantry that could carry most of these. Not even one of them. Because they were just too heavy. Only the Lancasters were built to handle something like that, or the superfortresses. It was observed that Bomber Command wasted thousands of aircrew who lost their lives carrying defective bombs to Germany. This was described as bad as sending men to battle with the rifles loaded with blanks. Now this is what the Royal Air Force reports. So not only was the strategic bombing campaign a failure, but it's now clear that General Dohette and Lord Trenchard were wrong. Bombers did not win the war. In fact, you can safely say that not only did bombing cities not shorten the duration of the war, but the strategic bomber campaign actually prolonged the war and exponentially increased the death toll of that war. This is a book by A.C. Grayling, Among the Dead Cities. Was the Allied bombing of civilians of World War II a necessity or a crime? Unwilling to face the German soldier on the battlefield, these strategists were prepared to drop bombs on his family from a safe height of over 10,000 feet. This indirect way of winning a war proved to be an illusion. Over 2 million people were killed and millions more injured and crippled as a result. The strategic bombing of cities proved to be not only unethical, but counterproductive. I want to conclude with a happy story. This is a beautiful story of, here's an American Flying Fortress B-17 coming out of Germany, and see the Luftwaffe plane. This heavily shot out B-17 was come across by a Messerschmitt 109 flown by pilot Franz Stiegler in 1943, and he looked at this and he could have finished it off. but he saluted the man and he guarded him. This is the American pilot. Here's the German pilot, the Messerschmitt pilot. And this man in the middle is the artist who recreated the scene. And they actually met together. Here you can see the pilot Stigler in the center there, and now meeting with the American pilot much later. And here there are special memorial of the showing reconciliation between fighting men. The thing is, the men on the ground and in the air were often far better people than the politicians who sent them there. And to think that there could be, I mean, you can see this plane is really shot up, and it made it home. Thanks to this fighter pilot who escorted them, showed them the way, because the navigational equipment was shot. They couldn't find the way anywhere. The radio shot. He guided them back to England where they could safely land. And neither man reported the story to the authorities. And years later, when they told it, people arranged to put them together, and they met, and they exchanged their respects and commemorated the event. Interesting, I bet there are hundreds of thousands of stories like this, of individual courage, character, and grace amongst combatants. I've never read in a history book about the Christmas truce in North Africa in 1942, but my father told me about it. When he was in the war in the 8th Army and fighting against my grandfather, who was on the other side in the Africa Corps, and they spoke about this, how they sang Christmas carols, how they went across on Christmas Day and played football and shared ration packs and showed pictures of their families. And there was a respect and a decency amongst many of the men on the ground, which wasn't shared. By the First World War. The First World War one's fairly well known. We've got a full minute here, Joyce Noel, but I haven't read that about the Second World War. But it happened at least at some places on the fronts.